Right, sorry, I'll do it properly. I'm used to shouting. No, we're going to speak. Right, sorry. Now, this session, which is starting somewhat late, will run for just about an hour in order that there's a gap before the next stage of today's activities. So we'll run it for an hour, and we're going to begin with a talk. This is the How Do We Govern session. Sorry, I've lost my own place here. And we're going to have an opening statement, and then there will be a panel discussion which we will facilitate. And that's not to say there won't be an opportunity for interventions from the floor, but we'll certainly start the debate from our co-chairing position here. And our opening statement is by Andy Altman, who is the CEO of Anacostia Waterfront Corporation in Washington, D.C., having previously been the planning director for that city from 2000 to 2005. Andy.
Thank you. Does this work?
Hello?
Okay, good.
It does.
Okay, very well. Okay. Well, I'm going to take a little different spin. I want to start by saying I'm not at all an academic, so I'm coming at this very much from the sort of bottom-up, practitioner-oriented view of the world, and take a little bit different lens to how we understand urban change and what's happening in our cities. So I want to start out today with one sort of proverb that maybe can capture this, and I can't tell you the scribe where this is from, which says that vision without action is a daydream, and action without vision is a nightmare. So with that in mind, I want to sort of open up what will be the sort of the subject of this talk, which is how do we begin to understand on the ground how cities are actually changing? We understand as we go in the urban age, looking at globalization, looking at urbanization, and from a sort of high level, but we see that it really lands at the level and the ground of the city. It's where the physical, the social, and the economic really come together. So how is the urban age, in a sense, implemented? In other words, how is it managed? How is the process of change managed by a city, by the myriad actors in a city who are coping with globalization? And even as Gerald Frug has pointed out, you know, a decision can be made that a city should be a global city, but it is at the level of the city where it mediates between globalization and what hopefully Enrique Penaloso would point out as a measure, which is the happiness of people in the city. How much can a city actually make its people happy? So I want us to think about this idea of urban models. We think a lot about what is the model of the city, what is good city form. We've been informed for years and years of different urban models that we learn. You can go back, even in the United States, of various tensions between Jefferson's view of the city, as Bruce Katz and I spoke about in New York, kind of anti-urban model from the beginning. Frank Lloyd Wright's model of the city, Le Corbusier's models of the city, garden cities notions of the city, urban renewal notions of the city, of today's ideas of what makes a good city. So models can, in some ways, have a very powerful impact. And the question, I think, for us is, what is the sort of relationship between these models of the city that we have and the actual practice of this, of what's happening in cities, and the unfolding of cities through the market forces and the reality of what is getting built? And I think that's part of what we really want to explore here in this connection between what's called the model of the city and the praxis of the city. But we see cities asserting, in many ways, a tremendous amount of control, a tremendous amount of their vision, let's say. We've heard earlier about London and the empowerment of the mayor and what they've done to begin to shape the destiny of their city. New York City, as we saw in our last conference, is always innovating and finding new ways to shape its form. Carl Weisbrod pointed out this morning the notion of how the crime statistic declined, something very much that was taken control by the city that unleashed many forces. We see in Shanghai the assertion of its vision for its future. So let's begin to understand this connection between theory and practice and models. And I think we want to ask a few questions. And I'm just going to show a few slides as a provocation to first ask, what is the model? Is there an operative model that informs the way the cities are actually unfolding? And what does that model say about our values, about the notion of a good city? Secondly, are these models really used? I mean, if you're in a city, whether they're city government or private sector or many of the actors, do we really pay attention to these models? Are they irrelevant to what's going on in the city? Are the market forces so strong that we just ignore them? Are they useful as a political diversionary tactic to say, yes, we have a model of the city, while in fact we're doing something different on the ground? Or are they very important to shaping policy of the city to have a vision? And I think we should explore what the role of models really is. Third, how are cities really organized for change? The notion of governance. What is it about how do cities organize themselves against these models in any way? We may have a nice notion of what the city should be, but is that in reality reflected with the governance of the city? Or are those systems in conflict, as Gerald Froude pointed out, between what the city can do, what the region can do, what the state can do? What is the role of leadership in cities? We look a lot at the issues of structure here, big structures of cities, but what about the notion of individuals and how they flourish in a city and the creativity, the role that the mayor can play in leadership and setting a vision, or community leaders or advocates? So how do these individual actors play a key role in shaping the city with these forces of globalization? What are their limits? How much can you really deal with? And finally, this whole notion of large-scale transformation of cities and the tension with democratization. Anthony Mayer pointed out earlier, many of us have a longing, right, for Paris in the time of Haussmann, right, when we see large-scale urban change. But is that, how does that, balanced with democratization? When we need to move forward with global cities, how do we change? So I want to point out some slides. These are questions I want to really provoke us as we look at this question of practice and models. And here we just take a few that we looked at earlier. Here's in London, the Thames Gateway, which is the future growth of London, and in fact has been said, of southeastern England, up to somewhere between 70 to 100,000 homes could be projected in this area. Here's the diagram of what it could be. At the same time, next, right, Anthony Mayer pointed out that the reality often is very different, that the notion of this as the new growth corridor, when it's translated from two-dimensional to three-dimensional urban form, can be very different, a disjunction between the model and idea of the gateway and what's unfolding. How do you affect this reality? How will Anthony and how will London begin to shape this in a different way to reflect the difference between what the model is and what they'd like to see as a creation of a whole new, what's been called the city within the city? How does the governance of London begin to reflect what the model of London and what they hope to achieve is? Next. In New York, we saw and we heard from, when we were in New York, Gerald Froude pointed out the region. Here's the regional plan of New York, right? Very complicated, right? Three-state region. And said, in fact, that New York City is a city without a brain, that gives us an inability to think, let alone it's denied the ability in many ways to think larger because it's constrained within these different states. Yet here's a regional plan, a model of what the region should be, different centers, different notions of density, what would be the ideal form of this metropolis, yet what is the reality of being able to do that? At the same time, we've heard from Kyle Reisbrod that New York is always innovating. It's always changing. Even in the face of this structural limitation, the city thrives, the city succeeds. Carl, in fact, has said that, over his 40-year career in New York, he's always seen the city and the mayor asserting their vision for the city, fighting against this and producing a great result today. Dion Sujic says that for the first time, New York is really shaping, it's a moment of New York shaping its reality. Next, Carl pointed out two visions earlier this morning, right? Here on the right is Lower Manhattan, on the left was the Hudson Yards, both in the same city. Are these in conflict because they lack a model? So is the lack of an overall vision for New York hurting it? And do these two projects, in fact, in conflict one another for the vision of New York City, let alone the place in the region? So it's something where maybe Carl will respond later and tell us, would an urban model of New York City itself have a different effect if that vision were, in fact, taken seriously and were implemented? Next. In the United States, there is a movement called the New Urbanism, which has found some favor also in the UK as well, or maybe we found favor of the UK and United States. Either way, it's the there's this charter of the New Urbanism, which is put out as a model, right? A model that says a compact form should be better than just the sprawling decentralization that we have in the United States. But it has been used many ways for a rationalization of the suburbs. Next. The predominant pattern in the United States that was shown earlier is one of decentralization. Even as cities are doing better, that Bruce Katz and I would argue that cities are doing better than they have in a generation, and have that conditions favor cities coming back and population returning to the city, this is still the reality of the predominant urban form. Is the model of the new urbanism, in fact, a distraction? Is it a diversion from what's really going on, which are the fundamental forces that are shaping our society in the United States? So are we only making the suburbs prettier, or are we actually able to affect the fundamental patterns of growth? So we have to ask whether that model that's been pointed up is really that effective in ultimately in shaping the urbanism that the new urbanism hopes to affect. Next. Very powerful in the United States, and maybe has some lessons as we look at Shanghai, is urban renewal, which was, how do we get rid of the old city, the United States, the old city being seen as inefficient, not economically competitive, as we went city by city and began to destroy the inner cities. Here's Washington in 1966 and 1957, which was the test case for urban renewal. Next. And began to build a different kind of city, one that destroyed the city fabric and built in its place what was seen as the more efficient city, but at the same time robbed it in many ways of those qualities of the city, the timeless qualities that we so enjoy, that we talked about earlier, the pedestrian-oriented city, the mixed-use city, high segregation of uses, segregation of incomes, abandonment of the street. Is that, and today, next, one of the major, when people say, what are the great planning innovations in the United States, it's simply correcting the mistakes of the past way of urban models that we used that defined the good city. So on the left, we had the public housing projects, which today on the right are being replaced, right, with what the city was 50 years ago before the city on the left was built. So the one slide on the right is actually 1998, completed, putting Washington back as it was before the previous model. So we have to ask ourselves, what are these new models telling us about the city, and be very careful in how we use them. And it has in fact led to a program across the United States called Hope 6, which has been to systematically tear down these housing projects that became warehouses for the poor and segregated the city with new mixed income and mixed use across the United States, really returning to what those basic elements of what make great cities are and had been destroyed by a previous model and notion of the city. Next. In Washington, D.C., which has always been a city about models because it was formed as an intentional capital of the United States, and this is where I come from and worked for many years, as you can see on the left, this was the powerful model of the City Beautiful movement at the turn of the century. Those of you who have been to Washington, this is the mall. On the bottom, is this was produced by Burnham and Olmsted, the great planners of the day at the turn of the century in the 1900s, a model of how to bring monumentality and beauty to the city, and was had its imprint on cities across the United States. It's a powerful model of urban change to let the cities breathe as a reaction to industrialization, put beauty into the cities, had very little to do with the poor, the people of the city, but was a very powerful idea of urban form that today in Washington you see. That legacy of that model, next, persists. This produced in 1996, which shows you the arrow of the notion of the city emanating from the capital, and even drawn, as you can see, to look as if it was produced in 1900, and just an updated of the monumental city, of the City Beautiful, and our goal in Washington has been to reverse this model. So these models can have a powerful impact, and we have to question them and wonder whether they relate to our notion of what the city is, who's the city for, who is this model serving. We have to understand that when we begin to look at this, which is the simple diagram that those of us as planners and urban designers are trained to think the simple line diagram is the powerful image, can also be powerfully destructive if not questioned as to what we're trying to accomplish and implement in our cities. Next. And finally, come to Shanghai, and I'll end on this because I think Tony's giving me the nod as to my time, getting anxious. which is to say we saw in our presentations at Chongqing University and heard today about the satellite cities, the form of what Shanghai as it grows, from the Shanghai of 1949, every 2 years will produce another Shanghai of 1949. The massive growth rates and the notion of channeling these into the 9 new towns and new cities. We saw some of these satellite cities, and yet we see a very powerful next gradient of urban density. So we have, on the one hand, the notion, the model of how this city should evolve, this really region should evolve, as satellite cities in a very rational form. On the other hand, the reality of where density and where direction is really occurring, and raises the question of what is model, what is reality, is planning connected to what's happening on the ground? Are the transit systems, in fact, serving what is going on with density? Are they serving a hypothetical model of satellite city? If you're successful in satellite city, how do you balance the old and the new? So I point all these out as just different as we've gone through these cities, the models that we're beginning to collect, I'm beginning to see what those realities as they raise questions for us on the ground. At the end of the day, and I'll conclude here, I think as we look around at the urban, as we look at the urban age and begin to go city from city, I think it's very important that we understand these processes of urban change, the role of managing that change, the models that we're using to understand cities, what we learn from what's successful, what the limitations are, as we begin to ask ourselves question not only of how the city's changing, but how we manage that change, and managing that change for whom. And with that, I'll go to you and the panel.